Now, the topic that we are beginning today is one of the most important tissues of the tooth. And while I am sorry that we have to start at such a difficult moment, as you are all trying to go crazy with your exams that are coming up. Well, you're going crazy. Come on, you're going crazy. what I really would like to do, tell the guy to stop, is to give you a solid introduction. And then, as we are picking up this topic again, when you come back from your spring break, at least there will be something there to start with. We will then do the laboratories and the small group sessions to deal with the topics that go along with it. But dentin really is a very critical subject, and we want to make sure that you understand this very well indeed. Now, as we will do with every one of the dental tissues, we'll make some basic statement, and just to get the basic outline here, and that is that dentin is a mineralized connective tissue. And in that sense, it is a mineralized connective tissue like bone would be, and so it has cells. The cells in this case are odontoblasts. What is strange and unique is that they are located in the pulp and not in the tissue itself. And then there is extracellular matrix. And the extracellular matrix, again, like in the bone, we have fibrous matrix with collagens, predominantly type 1, but also 5 and 6, which is usual. As you know, 5 and 1 go together. They're one complex. And the type 6 collagens are usually involved in the attachment of the cells to the extracellular matrix. So all of this is just fine. And then there is ground substance with proteoglycans, the smaller variety, not a huge aggregant type that you find in cartilage, and a series of non-collagenous proteins. We mentioned some of those last time, so let's look at it in a little while. The non-collagenous proteins of dentin are rather interesting, that there is one set that is dentin-specific, and that is dentin-cyallophosphoprotein, and then there is a group of non-specific non-collagenous proteins, which include, pay attention, dentin matrix protein 1. Remember last time I told you that while it was first discovered in dentin, it is not unique to dentin. It's found in bone, in a variety of hard tissues. So dentin matrix protein 1, bone cyallopropion, osteocalcin, osteonectin, osteopontin. So this is a whole series of non-specific non-collagenous proteins. But in the case of the specific proteins, what we have is a single transcript, that is dentin cyallophosphoprotein, which is then cleaved into dentin phosphoprotein. And notice how important that one is. That's 50% of all the non-collagenous proteins in the dentin. It's also known as phosphophorin. So this is specific for dentin. It is the largest group of non-collagenous proteins. This is a very critical component. And then the other component that results from cleavage is dentin cyallopropion, which seems to be mostly involved in the attachment of odontoblasts to predentin. Then there's a group of proteoglycans. They are generally the small ones. Decorin, which, as you know, literally decorates the collagen fibers. Lumican, biglycan, these are relatively small core proteins with one or maybe two side chains with glycosaminoglycans. So very different. As you recall, the aggregate molecule, you had a core protein, and then you had this whole series of side chains, really huge numbers, and then this became attached again to hyaluronic acid core. So these are huge things. In the case of these, you have a core protein with one or with two glycosaminoglycans chains. So they're very different in dimension, and they are not as enormous and important as in the case of the aggregants. Precisely what they do at this point is not 100% clear, so we're not going to bother with it. Okay. Now for each of these dental tissues, of which dentin is the first, we will give you this kind of a composition table. And essentially, the usual way in which we describe the composition of these hard tissues is by weight. That is simply because it is easier to weigh components after you have removed the water or whatever. It's easier to just put it on a scale and weigh it rather than estimate a volume. And so by weight, 70% of this tissue is mineral, hydroxyapatite. And then by weight, again, the remainder is organic matrix, fibrous matrix and ground substance, and 10% water. In that sense, as you will appreciate, it's somewhat different from bone, because in the case of bone, the numbers are slightly different, but nevertheless, they are relatively comparable, and we will come to that when we deal with cementum and alveolar bone. The volume the numbers are different, and for a simple reason that hydroxyapatite weighs more than it occupies space, but these are just put in there for fun. These you are not responsible for, but sometime down the line you should know, once we have done enamel, dentin, cementum and alveolar bone, you should be able to say which one is hardest, that is, which one has most hydroxyapatite, which one is softest, which one has least hydroxyapatite. In the case of dentin, it's kind of in the middle, so it's neither the hardest nor the softest dental tissue, it is literally in the middle. Now, if you want to describe what the essence of this tissue is, essentially, it is extracellular matrix, which is interrupted by a series of dentinal tubules. That's really what, if you describe the tissue, that's what it is like. Extracellular matrix, the components that I just showed you, and then there are a series of dentinal tissues that literally run through that extracellular matrix. And these dentinal tubules occupy 10% of the total volume of dentin. You have already seen them. I'm showing you here. The tubules run from the dentinoenamel junction to the pulp, and they have that unique S-shaped appearance, which we will come back to in a moment. And in these tubules, there is only this long cellular process of the odontoblast. The actual odontoblastic cell bodies, these are the cell bodies, are lying at the surface that is near the pulp of the dentin. So they are located in the pulp, and in a sense outside the tissue. Now, I've hijacked this from an ad. I'm sure they wouldn't mind. I don't know what the way was in which they figured out the numbers, but they are interesting numbers, and even if they're not totally correct, they are close to correct. What they're showing you here is, depending on the kind of restorative preparation that you make, here you have a class 2 preparation, here are crown preparations, and depending on the kind of preparation that you are making, you can, in fact, expose a pretty huge number of dentinal tubules. Even in a simple preparation like this, it is not uncommon to expose this many tubules. And in the case of a crown preparation, we are talking millions of tubules. Okay? And these millions of tubules, each of these tubules is a path to the inside pulp. And each of these tubules, therefore, can create a sensation of pain. What this little ad says, don't just desensitize, protect, which means is you can put something on to temporarily reduce the pain, but really what you should be doing is protect the pulp underneath it. Because the pulp can do interesting things in response to this kind of exposure. But it's just to kind of keep in mind that you are, when you're cutting in dentin, you're really cutting into live tissue, and the dentinal tubules are in fact providing with direct pathways into the pulp. It's something that you really have to be concerned about. Now let's look at the content of the dentinal tubules. The contents of the dentinal tubules, as this diagram indicates, are the cell processes of the odontoblast. Here the odontoblastic cell bodies and the cell process lies inside the tubule that is in the dentin. Now these are various images of the dentinal tubules. I've shown those to you before. An odontoblastic process here with some space on the outside. Here is a large multivesicular body inside the odontoblastic process. Here again is the odontoblastic process, but there is some other garbage lying around in the pericellular space. Sometimes it's collagen fibers, sometimes a little fat. There's any number of things. But the point is that the tubules contain odontoblastic processes. And some of them, not all, also may contain a nerve fiber. So a nerve fiber, an afferent nerve fiber, frequently is found in a dentinal tubule. You don't need nerve fibers in each dentinal tubule because the odontoblasts are all connected with each other and have gap junctional contact. So one gets stimulated, believe me, the others will too. Now, there's been a long discussion on how far the odontoblastic processes extend in the tubules. When they were first observed, and that was done with a little bit of methylene blue, it was very incredible. It was in the late 19th century, people were trying to study that, and they had pretty darn good eyes, I must say. But they found that the odontoblastic processes were going all the way to the DEJ. And then people got fancier and fancier tools. First they got fancier light microscopes, then they got transmission electron microscopes, scanning electron microscopes, labels, immunofluorescent labels, and the latest is the confocal scanning microscopy. And at this point, there still is not uniform agreement as to how far the odontoblastic processes extend. There is no disagreement that at the beginning of dentin formation, the odontoblastic processes extend all the way to the DEJ. So in a young tooth, newly formed, no question about it. These diagrams that you're seeing here show what it was based on scanning electron microscopy and transmission electron microscopy. People found that the odontoblastic processes in the mid-crown would only extend this far, and this was all empty. Can you read this? Yeah, actually you can. Wonderful. Then a little bit nearer the cervix, it would go this far. In the root, it would be all hardly any distance at all. And near the apex, it would still be a very limited distance. Now, interestingly, in confocal scanning microscopy, which is a fairly recent series of studies, two studies have been done so far. And listen to that, and I want you to understand what I'm saying. One study said, you know, basically what you can see there is, if you put the right labels on it, you can see the actual processes inside the dentinal tubules. One study said that the processes went all the way to the DEJ. One study said that the processes did not go all the way to the DEJ. Now, critically reading, what would you think is the more likely answer? No. Think again. If they're going all the way to the DEJ in one study, is it possible that the other one has an artifact? It is possible. If it is a matter of going all the way or not all the way, the person who finds that the odontoblastic process does not go all the way has to have some pretty good convincing reasons to say why that is true and why the other one, where you see the process going all the way, is not true. Because the artifact is easier to, in a way, to shrink the odontoblastic process away from where it originally was rather than the other way around. You cannot extend an odontoblastic process. You can make it shrink. Okay? So right now I would say that the ball is in the court of those that say it does not go all the way, and I tend to believe that the odontoblastic processes in normal circumstances probably do go all the way. Why do I also say that? Well, the person who found that the odontoblastic processes did not go all the way actually cut off the enamel with a rotary instrument. And when you start cutting off the enamel with a rotary instrument, you might just shorten the odontoblastic process, make it shrink. All right, but that's a lot of fun, and what I'm saying is, right now there is no common agreement about how far the odontoplastic process extends. Okay, that's this literally goes how far, how long have I been in this field? Almost 40 years. It has been an argument for almost 40 years. Okay, dentinal tubules. How great is their density, and does it vary in the dentin? Yes, it varies in the dentin. And the reason why it varies in the dentin is because of the way in which odontoblasts gradually become more crowded during dentin deposition. And so, as you will recall, the dentino-enamel junction where the odontoblast start was a larger surface than the area of the pulpal surface where they end up. And so what you find is that in the pulp, in the dentin near the pulp, there's a higher density. You also find that in the crown, the dentin has a higher density of tubules than in the root, up to 5 times. That just means that they are, the odontoblasts are, again, not lying as close to each other. And then you find also that in younger individuals, the dentinal tubules have a higher density. That is because as you grow older, the tubules are becoming narrower and finally become occluded. So there are these differences. And clearly, if you are concerned about the effect that your work has on the underlying pulp, the density of the dentinal tubules does make a difference. Dentinal tubules in the adult tooth vary in diameter. Let me give you a straight diameter, from 2 micrometers near the pulp to about 0.5 micrometer near the dentinal enamel junction. So the dentinal tubules are narrower near the dentinal enamel junction than they are near the pulp. And that is, of course, what you're seeing here. Near the dentinal enamel junction, you have narrower tubules, and further apart near the pulp, you have wider tubules and closer together. Now, each of these tubules can then also be branched. And the branches are varied in their course and in their dimension. The biggest branches that we have are the delta branches. They are typically found in the crown, in the peripheral dentin, and they are in the ballpark figure of the regular tubular dimension, about 0.5 to 1 micrometer in diameter. But that's one, terminal or delta branch. I'll show you pictures in a moment. Then you find lateral branches. They branch at 45 degree angles, typically found in root dentin. They are narrower. And finally, there are the so-called micro branches that occur at right angles, both in the root and in the crown. And these are really minimally sized structures. Depending on where you find them, these first two branches, these first two classes of branches, are probably reflective of earlier connections between the cells, that when the cells were moving back and laying down dentin, they formed branches first while they still were connected to the neighboring cell, but then gradually that may have been lost as time went on. But the point is that these branches probably reflect earlier communications between adjacent cells. That is not so for the micro branches. We don't really know what they are. All right, let's look at the terminal branches. Terminal branches are found. Here is the DEJ. This is DEJ. And the terminal branches are found in this little area right here, which is approximately 100 micrometers. Hey, that number has been heard before. What does the 100 micrometers tell you? Peripheral dentin, the first form dentin, mantle dentin. 100 micrometers, mantle dentin. At the periphery, immediately below the DEJ, it also has the terminal branches of the odontoblasts. And when you study the first beginnings of dentinogenesis, the odontoblasts do not yet have a single process. They may have multiple processes, and that's what you're seeing here. So they may have multiple processes that gradually then come together into a single process. So terminal branches or delta branches are what you're seeing right here. These are the lateral branches. Lateral branches are typically found in the root dentin. Fewer tubules and highly branched, and they're coming off at about 45 degree angles. So that is something that is typical for root dentin. Crown dentinal tubules are fairly smooth and straight, don't have a lot of lateral branching at all. Root dentin does. And then finally, we have the micro branches, and you can see them here, coming off at approximately right angles. You see them here, you see them not always terribly clear. There are some here. But the question really is, what are they doing? We really have no real good idea. So that may just be an artifact, and we don't worry about it. So much for the branches. So we have talked about the density, the dimension, what is inside the tubules. Now let's talk about the curvatures. And the curvatures that we have in dentin are two types. One is known as the primary curvature, and you can bet your bottom dollar that the other one is secondary curvature. So the primary curvature is the S-shaped curvature of the tubules, the ones that I've already mentioned, starting here, going down like so, and that is roughly the organization of the tubule. This one is a little bit less well pronounced as the first one I showed you, but the S-shaped curvature is really the result of the movement of the odontoblast as it became progressively crowded. Remember that last time when I talked to you about how the progressive crowding occurred, the tubules were in a sense forced in this direction because the odontoblasts were forced in this direction. And so the S-shaped curvature is probably an accident of the progressive crowding. But clinically, it is important for you to realize that something that you are doing here may affect the crown here. And that is what's shown up in this picture, and I hope you can see it. Let me just show it to you over here. Roughly at this level, when you look at it below, the enamel looks a little slightly reddish. I hope you can see that. It's subtle. This is not something big, but if you are a patient that has the tooth, you know it. And this reddish color is the result of some reddish material that was put in the root canal by the endodontist. And this pigment was actually traveling up in this direction upward here, and you can see this reddish material in the cervical half of the crown. And that's something that you have to be aware of, that you, when you do something in the pulp, especially if you have a root canal filling that has a certain pigmentation, that can in fact travel up the dentinal tubules and cause a discoloration in the crown. Of course, the other thing is that if something is done here, the odontoblast is affected is down here. That is the reverse argumentation. All right, primary curvature, therefore, is the S-shaped. The secondary curvatures of the tubules are a result of the diurnal activity of dentinogenesis. And in fact, what you find is you can have a sinusoidal curve and a full wavelength of a sinusoidal curve is between those two vertical lines and represents 24 hours of dentin formation. And what you find is that dentin forms approximately 4 micrometers over a 24-hour period. We can measure that because we have, in fact, some data to show that. So this, then, is everything so far they've told you had to do with the tubules. The contents, the dimensions, the branching, the density, the curvatures. Now we go to the extracellular matrix. So tubules we have done with pretty much. Now let's look at the extracellular matrix. And what we have in the extracellular matrix are regional variations. And the regional variations that we have depend on where you are. We recognize, first of all, circumpalpal dentin, and secondly, peripheral dentin. The circumpalpal dentin is the bulk of the dentin, all of the dentin that surrounds the pulp up to a certain level. And that certain level is where the peripheral dentin begins. That is a layer of 100 to 200 micrometers thick, which may lie either adjacent to the dentino-enamel junction when you're in the crown, or to the dentino-cemental junction when you're in the root. And the peripheral dentin is in fact different. As we saw last time, the peripheral dentin in the crown is known as mantle dentin. And we know that that mantle dentin was less well mineralized. It had two different kinds of populations of collagen fibers. And it was the second population of collagen fibers was in fact the one with the heavier collagen fibers, which is usually the cause why dentin doesn't get as well mineralized. But then, in addition, in the root, we also have a peripheral layer, also roughly that same dimension, 100 to 200 micrometers thick, this time lying next to the dentinocementum junction. And that is the site where we have a very unique phenomenon that is known as the granular layer of Tomes. The granular layer of Tomes, again, is an area of mineralization deficiencies. So again, in this area near the outermost layers of the root, what you find is that the dentin is less well mineralized, and we will come to the reason for that in a moment. So let's look at the circumpalpal dentin. Circumpalpal dentin was that typical dentin with the collagen fibers running perpendicular to the cores of the tubules in a bird's nest arrangement, if you look at it from the surface where you see the openings of the tubules. But then there was this other layer of peripheral dentin, and that is the mantle dentin. The mantle dentin, here shown in a polarization micrograph, what you're seeing here, this is enamel, this is dentin, and because of the particular orientation of the light as it is exiting the analyzer, we can make changes in the color. And what we see is that the collagen fibers in the circumpalpal dentin, which are here, are running in this direction. I can tell because I know how the picture was made, and it was that direction caused the blue color. And in this area here, the fibers, the predominant area of course of the fibers, is at right angles to that. Those are these extra fibers that you see here. So the mantle dentin, once again, has two populations of fibers, the normal collagen fibers that you find in both the circumpalpal and the mantle dentin. So that's one set. And then you have these extra thick fibers that are running at right angles to the DEJ and approximately parallel to the tubules, and that is that second population of collagen fibers that you only find in the mantle dentin. And just now to make the point, when you look at a histologic section through dentin, you don't see the different orientations of the collagen fibers unless you use polarization microscopy, but what you can see is the area with the terminal branches or delta branches. And it is that same area where you have the mantle dentin. So can you locate the mantle dentin approximately? Yes, you can. Can you see the collagen fibers that make the mantle dentin so unique? No, you cannot unless you are looking either with electron microscopy or polarization microscopy. Now, the presence of mantle dentin, as I indicated last time, has an interesting effect on the spread of caries. This is a caries lesion in the crown. This is in the enamel. And you see how that carious lesion is literally organized like a little funnel-shaped lesion. And then when it hits the DEJ, all of a sudden, the caries spreads below the DEJ in the mantle dentin. So the mantle dentin is an area where you can have preferential rapid spread because of the less well mineralized nature of that tissue. So that's one. So we have circumpulpal dentin and peripheral dentin. The peripheral dentin can be mantle dentin or granulate of tomes in the root. Now there is another distribution of dentins which is going in a different direction, and that is peritubular dentin and intertubular dentin. Peritubular dentin is best seen when you are making a cross-section to dentinal tubules. You see around each of these dentinal tubules, I hope you see this little bright light area that is a halo-like structure. That is peritubular dentin. Everything else is intertubular dentin. So peritubular dentin is that thin layer of about 1 micrometer thick that is lying immediately around the lumen of the tubule, while the intertubular dentin is everything else. Here is a good image of that. You are now looking, here is the lumen of a dentinal tubule. The dentinal tubule goes in this direction. And if you look closely, you see that there is here a different kind of structure than the intertubular dentin here, peritubular intertubular dentin. And you notice that the peritubular dentin is very fine-grained, and it's very regular-looking, while the intertubular dentin is pretty much coarser, and really not as very delicate. Now, what's the difference between the two? The intertubular dentin, the stuff that you see here, has collagen fibers. The peritubular dentin does not. It has non-collagenous proteins, it has proteoglycans, but it doesn't have collagen fibers. It is extremely highly mineralized, so this has lots of mineral. While in this area here, the intertubular dentin is far less well mineralized. When you make a histologic section and you decalcify it first, like here, you notice that the openings of the tubules seem to be wider and there is no peritubular dentin visible. When you are decalcifying dentin, you literally decalcify all of the peritubular dentin. So all of this light area here, all this area here is lost, and what you're ending up with is a larger opening of the tubule. Okay? Now, why should that bother you? Because it has enormous clinical importance. Peritubular dentin is seen here in a variety of ways. Again, you're seeing the light areas here are the highly mineralized peritubular dentin. This is intertubular dentin. And now when you are demineralizing it, what you have is nothing here. It's an opening. What is left standing here is a kind of a little sleeve of organic material that sits on the inner wall of the peritubular dentin, which is known as lamina limitans. It is literally an organic structure that covers the odontoblastic process. But the point is that as a result of the acid, the peritubular dentin is lost. It's not here. It's gone. And now think about what you do when you do dentistry. Here is, after a cavity preparation, you have a lot of slurry. You're moving things around. There's a lot of slurry being produced. And that produces what we call a smear layer. The smear layer literally covers the bottom of the cavity prep, or whatever, however you're looking at it, but you're looking at the part that is the dentin. And it literally also fills the openings of the dentinal tubules. So this is kind of sitting here. Now, when you're getting very neat and nice and you clean it up, and when you remove the smear layers, this is what you're seeing here. Here are the tubules, and now all the openings are looking at you. Every one of them a direct path to the pulp, okay? So tell the patient to suffer. But no, seriously, the patient still doesn't feel it when you're doing this. They feel it later on when the anesthetic wears off. And now, if you are really going to try to make it clean, you actually use some acetone or in some cases even a little acid, and then you remove also the peritubular dentin. So basically, that's what they call dentin surface conditioning. Here's the untreated dentin. The smear layer is on top. The smear plug, that is part of the smear layer, extends into this. So this is all garbage that you have produced during the cavity preparation, which nicely covers the dentinal surface and, in fact, the part of the dentinal tubule. And now what you're going to do, because you're going to use bonding techniques, you're going to try to make a very nice resin restoration. And so what you're going to do is you're going to use acid. And that acid, first of all, removes not only the smear layer, it removes the most superficial dentin, and it will also remove part of the peritubular dentin, making the tubules, the tubular openings, really wide. Okay? Now, depending on what you're going to do, you are going to use a resin that comes with a monomer, which you then have to polymerize. And essentially, what you hope is going to happen is that the monomer literally goes into the partially decalcified dentin matrix, and there it polymerizes and actually communicates and connects with the collagen fibers that are still present, and hopefully establishes a bond. That is the theory. In fact, what we find is that bonding is very successful when we're using enamel. And you will see that bonding has pretty much become mainstream treatment in whenever you use enamel. When you are using bonding techniques on dentin, it's fine for the first episode. It helps to desensitize the tooth. But a few years later, when you're coming back to it, you frequently those bonds are in fact failing, and so dentin bonding is not as successful as enamel bonding is. I will just go beyond that now. What you end up with ultimately is a situation where you have the resin here in the dark, and little dark plugs of resin extending in the upper parts of the dentinal tubules. It makes for a very good lock onto the tissue, and hopefully there is some bonding of the polymerized bonding agent onto the dentin. But as I said, the experience has been that long term these are not terribly successful. Alright, so now what we have done, we have looked at the tubules, we have looked at the extracellular matrix. Now let's look at some things that occur during dentinogenesis. One is lines that form during dentinogenesis, and then we will also look at mineralization deficiencies. Let's first talk about lines. There are two sets of lines that form. And when we talk lines, actually they are surfaces, because you have to think of it three-dimensionally. The big ones are known as contour lines, and they have the name of Owen. Contour lines of Owen are formed at a time of stress to the organism, in which the stress is conferred also on the cells that are producing the dentin. And what they are doing is they produce less well mineralized dentin, and that shows up as a line when you make a section through the tooth. Birth is such an example. Birth is not a pleasant experience most of the time, unless you're born by cesarean. And so for the duration of the time, the length of time that it took for birth to occur, your organism is stressed, and you get a neonatal line. So neonatal line is one example of a contour line of Owen, but there are several others. So that's one set. And then there are another set of lines. They are known as the imbrication lines of von Ebner. And they are essentially 24-hour period lines. So again, the diurnal pattern of dent information, which produced the secondary curvatures, also can produce imbrication lines of von Ebner. Here is the apposition pattern of dentin. And we went through that before. We understand how you get these different lines. And when you have this apposition pattern, anytime when during this formation of dentin something happens, like birth, which is shown here, you get what is known as a contour line, which is an isochronous line. It's a line that is formed by all the cells at a particular similar time. One can get artificial contour lines of Owen, and you see this in this beautiful section that is from our collection, where this individual was given at very regular intervals tetracycline. And tetracycline binds to the hydroxyapatite that's being laid down at the time, and so you can get literally artificial isochronous lines like this, which have the pattern of Owen's lines, contour lines of Owen's. And you know, you can see why it's called a contour line. It literally has this delightful contour. Okay? So contour line of Owen is when there is a stress in the organism, all the odontoblasts at that time that are producing that particular bit of dentin produce a slightly hypomineralized dentin, which remains visible in the tissue. And here are the von Ebner lines. The von Ebner lines are the ones that you're seeing here in the dentin. This is an H&E section of dentin. And the von Ebner lines are two groups. One are a slightly darker group and more pronounced. That's what you're seeing here. These are von Ebner lines that are 20 micrometers apart. And when you look closer, there are finer lines in between. The von Ebner lines can be 20 micrometers apart, and the finer pattern is 4 micrometers apart. Remember, the diurnal amount of dentin that we form is 4 micrometers. So the finer pattern is really the diurnal pattern. Why every fifth day you form a stronger line is not clear at this moment, but it's something that we observe. Of course, the diurnal pattern, you know, is produced by your internal clock. Internal clock is located in the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And in that nucleus, we have, in fact, also some other effects from external clocks. But this is the central clock. But there are peripheral clocks that have to do with feeding and with light. So the central clock is really sometimes reset by these external influences. But the basic point is of a circadian clock is that you have a series of molecules that are being produced, and these molecules have the ability to turn off the mechanism that produces themselves. And so there is a time which the molecules are being produced, and then when they form this combination, they can go back and negatively influence the nucleus and the DNA in the nucleus. The production stops. Then when the production stops, these things no longer bother the nucleus, and then the production gets going again. So it's an interesting situation where the production of the proteins also at the same time builds in the slowdown of the DNA, and then when the DNA is slowed down, there are no more proteins to slow down the DNA, and the DNA starts up again. So that's the theory of the circadian clock, and it works very well. And by and large, we're having 24 hours. If, however, we don't have external influences, as you well know, gradually that clock will start to get off a little bit, each time a little bit more and a little bit more. All right, so these were the lines. Contour lines of Owen, big interferences. The diurnal lines, which are really a 24-hour pattern. Why do we have a 24-hour pattern? Well, when you are sleeping, you are producing less collagen, and you are producing more mineral inside the tissue. So there is an alternating situation where during the nighttime you produce less extracellular matrix, especially collagen, and you are mineralizing the tissue more. So that produces that interesting difference in the lines that you find. All right, then let's look at these imperfections of mineralization. The last time I mentioned that, I said if there is an imperfection in the mineralization of dentin, it does not get repaired later on. So once you have an imperfection, it stays. And the imperfections that we have, there are two of them. One is the interglobular dentin areas, which are found at a very particular region of the crown dentin between outer and middle thirds. I'll show the particular location. And then there is another imperfection, which is the granular layer of tongues. That was that peripheral root dentin that I mentioned to you earlier. Let's look at them. Here is the interglobular dentin. You see here a globular mineralization front. We mentioned that last time. And when these globules in the mineralization front fuse very nicely together, you get a more or less linear pattern. But when they don't fuse very nicely together, little areas in between are left open. And those areas are poorly mineralized. They are very much like pre-dentin. And these are known as interglobular dentin areas. So interglobular dentin areas are poorly mineralized part of the dentin. The matrix is poorly mineralized. Of course, the rest of the dentin structure is there. So here you see it. These dark areas here are interglobular dentin. The tubules run right through it. They're not bothered by it. But the matrix is deficient in mineralization. And these mineralizations, these deficiencies will remain because you are not going to repair them later on. Now, essentially, these interglobular dentin areas are found, as I said earlier, at a specific part. They are found in the crown, and they are found between the outer third and the middle third of the dentin. You see here just a little bit of overlap as you go into the crown. These are some of the interglobular dentin areas. This is about where it stops. But very typically, it is along that line that you find the interglobular dentin areas. Now, the granular layer of tomes starts right here. Here is the cervix, the dentino-enamel cementum junction. And now here, at this peripheral dentin, you're seeing a series of little grains, dark little grains like this. And you're seeing it here at a higher power. This would be cementum. This is dentin. And here, you see that area, and you see some of those grains are in focus. That is known as the granular layer of tomes. There's a long debate about what the granular layer of tomes amounts to. There's no question that these are imperfections in mineralization, and probably they are imperfected because they are cross-sectioned collagen fibers in this area that are relatively thick and therefore centrally are not well mineralized, and that leads to this formation of granular layer. There's no particular clinical reason for us to get bothered by it. We just mention it. Now, we end up with a few bits of aging changes. Aging changes in dentin. Dentin, of course, is a tissue that starts forming when the tooth starts forming. And it continues to form throughout life while you have your teeth and while they continue to be vital. And so what you can see here is a situation that's three different ages. This is around 20 or so. This is, let's give it a rough idea, 45. This is 70. I'm guesstimating, okay? They are somewhat variable. I actually have the precise numbers because this is work done by my predecessor, Dr. Applebaum, but very carefully done study in which the ages of the individuals were known, and you could see how gradually dentin continued to deposit. All the dentin that is formed until the time that the apex is formed is known as primary dentin. Okay, so primary dentin is the dentin that's formed until the apex is completed. After that, there is a considerable slowdown. The odontoblasts do not form dentin at the same rate, but they do continue to form dentin, but they have fewer odontoblasts. Some odontoblasts have in fact died. Whoa, away, away. Fewer odontoblasts, the tubules, so there are fewer tubules as well, and the tubules change the shape, their orientation, change direction. So that's the second one. And thirdly, because the dentin forms slower, the dentin is better mineralized. Okay, so secondary dentin, which forms after the completion of the apex, has fewer tubules, it has a change in the direction of the tubules, and the dentin is better mineralized. Now, if you look at this, I want you to see where the secondary dentin forms first. This here is the secondary dentin, right here. And over here, the secondary dentin forms. A little bit here, but mostly here. And that is below the surface that is being loaded. So, if you think about how the incisor teeth are articulating, the incisor teeth are being loaded, these are upper incisors, by the lower incisor teeth against the cingulum. And what you find is that the secondary dentin tends to form at a slightly higher rate below the loaded surfaces, as opposed to the opposite side where the surfaces are unloaded. But there's something else here that you may notice. In this case here, the pulp is now limited to this area. And that means that you can do heroic dentistry on these teeth because there's almost no pulp tissue left. So you can do much more incredible crown preparations on teeth like this that are considerably older because of the secondary dentin. You don't have to worry too much about pulp exposure. That's in contrast to the primary teeth of kids where, you know, you touch the dental enamel junction, the next thing you know, you're already in the pulp. So, you know, in older people, this is a real advantage. You can do major dentistry and nobody will know the difference. Okay. Here is another one. In normal aging, you form sclerotic dentin. What is sclerotic dentin? Well, here is an example of it. This is a slice of a tooth, it's a root, and the healthy dentin, the normal dentin, is opaque. You cannot look through it. But near the apex, you can read literally newsprint through that dentin. The dentin is transparent. That's another word for it. Transparent or sclerotic dentin. What does it mean? What it means is that you have had tubules in here, dentinal tubules, that have become occluded. So the dentinal tubules are occluded here with mineral in the lumen. And so now what you have is a mineralized tissue that is essentially uniform. You don't have the interruption of tubules and organic material. You have a uniform mineralized tissue, and that is transparent. As long as you have organic interruptions, it is opaque. But if it is uniformly mineralized and all of the tubules are filled with that mineral, you have transparent dentin. And this change begins in the apical region and gradually goes in a coronal direction. And you can actually do measurements of how much of a height of the transparent dentin you have as opposed to the normal height of the root. And there are some ways of estimating somebody's age as a result. Not very delicate, not very refined technique, but you can use some of it. If a person has a lot of sclerotic dentin, it is not a young individual anymore. In some sections of young teeth, you may find areas like this. Here are tubules that are cross-sectioned in this area, But here in these lighter areas where the small axis, you see there are almost no tubules present. There were tubules. You can see the tubules actually if you look very closely. They are fine little points, but the tubules are now closed up. And so sclerotic changes do begin relatively early. And very typically, and this is a beautiful section, sclerotic dentin also in the root tends to form first on the mesial and distal side. Mesial and distal, I think. While on the buccal and lingual side, it is not forming. So here is the opaque area with still live odontoblasts, odontoblastic processes, and open tubules. And here the tubules are occluded. Here the tubules are occluded. And so that is where you have the transparent or sclerotic dentin. When this happens, you see here sclerotic dentin underneath caries, where it's another way of happening. Sclerotic dentin gradually fills the tubule, and when that occurs again, you can have transparent dentin underneath caries. So it is an aging process, but it also occurs when a mineral gets reprecipitated under a caries lesion. This is what you're seeing here. Here is a caries lesion in the enamel. It has spread out along the DEJ for a while, then it has continued on into the dentinal tubules of the dentin. And now you see two things. You see a dead tract. Dead tract is essentially what you're seeing here. And that is an area where the tubules no longer have a live odontoblastic process, but the tubules are still patent. The lumen is still there. So dead tracts you typically see in a ground section as a dark group of tubules. Immediately adjacent to this area of the dead tract, you see a much brighter dentin, and that is sclerotic dentin. What has happened is the mineral that was released from here reprecipitated here inside the tubules of the dead tract, and as a result, you got sclerotic dentin. So that is, as I said, sclerotic dentin forms as a normal age change, but it also forms underneath dentin caries. Let me just see how far we are here. Okay, we're almost there. Hang in there, kids. Okay, one of the really nasty things that can happen, as you already noticed, is that odontoblasts can be killed under the influence of toxins, of bacteria, a variety of other things, including your work on a tooth. If you work on a tooth and produce too much heat, you can kill the odontoblasts. Okay? It really can happen. And some of the explanations for tooth pain as a result of a variety of actions, including yours, has been the so-called hydrodynamic theory. Have you heard about this at all? Yes. You have? Good. Then you can tell me all about it. That's good. That's good. All right, let me just... I'll briefly review it for you, just because you are a little weak from all of the studying. There is different flow of fluids. The net flow usually is fluid flow from the tubules into the pulp, but it can also be reversed. And it gets really reversed when there is activation of the sensory branch near the odontoblastic processes, which can happen for a variety of reasons. When that happens, you get a firing of the nerves. There is a sudden increase of outflow of the fluid in the dentinal tubule, and as a result of that, the odontoblast gets pulled along with it. I will not go any further into the specifics of the pain because that is another story. But histologically what happens is that when odontoblasts get pulled into the dentinal tubules as a result of this increased flow outward, what you find is, if you look at a section like this, you see these little dark areas. These are the nuclei of the odontoblasts. Odontoblasts literally are sucked into the dentinal tubules, and there they die. They can no longer survive. And you see that here they are in this area here, they're still in the predentin, but they literally are pulled into the tubules. And when you look a little bit later on, what you find is evidence of cell death. The odontoblasts perish inside the tubules, and now what you're getting is any number of different cells. You get dendritic cells that begin to sample what's happening inside the tubules. You get neutrophilic leukocytes that are beginning to come in there. Here's an erythrocyte. It's a mess, and in a little while you have to remove it. And what you then will have, hopefully, is a quick response of the pulp underneath. If the pulp is still healthy, if the pulp is still able to respond, some of the cells nearby very quickly start undergoing a differentiation. And what they do is they produce a big clot of what is known as reparative dentin. This is irregular secondary dentin, and in fact it is osteodentin because the cells are literally enclosed inside the tissue. This is short-term, very quick reaction and a quick response. After that, the reactive dentin will go on, and the reactive dentin will start to produce a more regular layer of irregular secondary dentin. Reactive dentin is formed by new odontoblasts that have just literally differentiated, and they replace the older odontoblasts that have perished. So if odontoblasts die, get sucked in the tubule, the tubules become dead tracts, and hopefully you get new cells to produce new dentin. This kind of new dentin formation occurs particularly fast in the case of primary teeth. Primary teeth have a terrific ability to produce reactive dentin, and so that's what you're seeing right here. All right, where do these new cells come from? There are two possible suggestions. One is the so-called subodontoblastic cells. If these are the odontoblastic cell bodies, there are, in fact, subodontoblastic cells that form very tight connections, gap junctional contacts with the odontoblasts. And when the odontoblasts disappear, these cells tend to move in and differentiate. The second group of cells that is available is coming, and what you're seeing here. If this is the normal, this is normal, with a group of odontoblasts lining the pulpal surface of the dentin, once they have been killed, you get inflammatory cells, you get plasma cells, neutrophilic leukocytes, the whole shebang, which starts to remove some of the garbage. And what you find is that cells from around the blood vessels begin to undergo proliferation. As they come to the area of the predentin, they differentiate and they become new odontoblasts, and you find new dentin being formed. So these are the possible replacement cells that we have. Now, can we help them? And yes, the answer is yes, we can help them. We now know which of the signals, the molecular signals, are useful for cells that are already committed, dental cells, and all they need is just a little push to become odontoblasts. And so bone morphogenetic proteins, especially 2 and 4, and transforming growth factor beta 1, are able to stimulate reactive dentin. So what you can do is if you have a deep cavity prep, or if you know